Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Last time, British MP George Galloway denounced his country and ours and also Israel for their wars of conquest and their occupations in the Middle East. And he said that the root of the conflicts and of terrorism is Palestine. Today, in part two, Galloway starts with Israeli-U.S. atrocities in Lebanon and in Palestine, and then speaks of Iran and the entire Arab Middle East. He gave this speech in Toronto in November 2006, and it's every bit as relevant now as then. Some of the actors have changed, but the play remains the same. Just substitute Obama for Bush, Gordon Brown for Tony Blair, and you can deliver the speech tonight. So, on to Lebanon and Palestine! God, I'm sounding more like Ariel Sharon every day.
As I told you, I became involved in this in 1975. In 1977, I went to Lebanon for the first time. I spent time in two camps, then unknown, but which later, in 1982, etched themselves into the Hall of Infamy. The camps of Sabra and Shatila. In these camps lived thousands and thousands of Palestinian refugees. Israel invaded Lebanon. They smashed their way through the south. They perched their artillery on a high hill and systematically reduced the Arab capital of Beirut to ash. The great English journalist Robert Fisk, then writing for the London Times, I remember it still, described something he saw there for the first time. Little children, Palestinian and Lebanese, in hospitals in West Beirut, their insides cooking. Children baking from the insides. White smoke coming from their nose and mouth. Burning inside, incinerating inside with the use of phosphorus gas fired by the Israeli armed forces on Lebanon. So disastrous was the assault on Beirut that the leaders of the Lebanese National Movement called with heavy hearts and tears on their faces on President Arafat. I was there. They told him that the cost in human suffering was too great and that with a heavy heart they must ask the fighters of the Palestinian resistance to leave Beirut. Arafat agreed immediately and immediately concluded a deal with the American plenipotentiary Philip Habib, in which the Palestinian fighters agreed to leave Beirut with their weapons on board ships to sail thousands of miles to Tunisia. And in return, the so-called international community agreed to protect their women and children and old people that they were leaving behind in the camps. No sooner had these ships left the harbor when General Ariel Sharon, long may he lie in his coma and suffer, the butcher of Beirut, Sharon, personally, he didn't order someone to do it. He did it himself, brought gigantic searchlights to the perimeter of the camps to shine through the night as bright as day, so the fascist butchers of the Lebanese phalange could go from house to house, from shack to shack, bayoneting the women, children and old men that were left behind, killing thousands of them, leaving their bodies bloating in the sun in the camps for the next few days. The same Ariel Sharon that we were later told we must treat as a statesman, as a legitimate leader, whilst Arafat, who made the deal to save Lebanon, was blackguarded, was isolated, was insulted, and finally was murdered. That's the double standard. That's the injustice. The insult that's added to the injury is that in the Palestinians' case, the victim of terrorism is called the terrorist, and the terrorist state of Israel is called the legitimate government and the legitimate state. You know, they talk a lot about Ahmadinejad and his threat to wipe Israel off the map. Well, in fact, he never even said that. But in any case, Iran is not in a position to wipe Israel off the map. But Israel is in a position to wipe Iran off the map, and all other Arab and Muslim countries too. We know this thanks to the brave Jewish whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu, who spent 18 years in solitary confinement in an Israeli dungeon for telling us. But in any case, the only country in the Middle East which has been wiped off the map is Palestine, wiped off the map by Israel, its people scattered to the four winds as refugees for half a century, living in camps, living in exile, with no papers, with no passports, with no status, with no national identity, hunted from pillar to post, massacred by Israel, by Arab regimes, unable to return to their homes. Whilst anybody can convert to being a Jew and be given the automatic right to go and live on the land and in the houses of the Palestinians who are forbidden to return home. And you know, there's one camp in particular which makes this point with perfect clarity. 4 years ago, at Easter time, when the Church of the Nativity, the birthplace of Jesus, was in flames, surrounded by Israeli tanks, priests and nuns lay dead, unburied in the crypt, and the Christian leaders of the world didn't lift a finger to come to the assistance of the birthplace of Jesus. That week, in a camp called Jenin, 1 square kilometer, 13,000 families, a camp consisting of rancid, rat-infested hovels, in which these 13,000 families had lived for 50 years. Now, the exquisite uniqueness of that camp is that if these shacks had roofs strong enough to stand on, the refugees of the camp could see the shining city of Haifa on the Mediterranean coast, which was their city. They can see from the camp their own houses, their own trees, their own gardens, their own oranges being lived in, played in, enjoyed by foreigners from Montreal, from Toronto, from London, from New York, mainly from New York, living in their houses, while these 13,000 families live in a state of indescribable misery. And they wonder why so many suicide bombers come from Jenin. The miracle is that they're not all suicide bombers coming out of the camp of Jenin. But on top of that misery, General Sharon, him again, 20 years later, sent his army to smash this camp and massacre its inhabitants. And I was there just 2 or 3 days after the massacre with my friend Ron Mackay, who's with me tonight. The smoke was still rising from the ruins. The smell of the bodies under the crushed houses, bulldozed flat like pancakes, could still be smelt. We saw a young man walking across the camp carrying a sharp weapon. Very young man. We were surprised at the respect that the elders were paying him. We asked who he was. Turned out he was the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which had led the defense of the camp. We asked to speak to him. He told me this. And this I aim at the Arab Canadians here principally. He said, "Our young men fought day and night to defend this camp, to defend our families, to defend our religion, to defend our cause. But in the end, we could fight no more. Not because we ran out of courage, but because we ran out of ammunition. And why did we run out of ammunition, he said? Because the corrupt kings and the puppet presidents of the Arab world sealed their borders so that not a single bullet, not a single weapon, not a single volunteer could arrive to help defend the refugees in this Jenin refugee camp. This too is a subject to which I shall return.
President W. Bush once referred to Ariel Sharon as this man of peace. To his credit, Sharon kept a straight face all the while. The massacre at Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon was the war crime from hell, and this immediately after the United States had guaranteed the safety of the Palestinian women, children, and old men in the camps. I guess we had our fingers crossed when we made that promise. All of the historical details Galloway cites are confirmed by journalist Robert Fisk, incidentally, in Fisk's two fine histories of the Middle East. These are Pity the Nation, and more recently, The Great War for Civilization. Both highly recommended by yours truly. We'll return for the conclusion of the talk after a musical break. Galloway mentioned that the town of Jenin, site of yet another glorious, victorious massacre led by Sharon, the town of Jenin had been the home of many suicide bombers. David Rovix has a song about Jenin.
Child, what will you remember when you recall your 16th year? The horrid sound of helicopter gunships, the rumble of the tanks as they drew near. As the world went about its business, I burned another tank of gasoline. Dow Jones lost a couple points that day while you were crying in the city of Jenin. Did they even give your parents warning before they blew the windows out with shells? While you hid inside the high school basement, amidst the ringing of church bells, as you watched your teacher crumple by the doorway, and in England they were toasting to the Queen, you were so far from the thoughts of so many, huddled in the city of Jenin. Were you thinking of the taunting of the soldiers, or of the they smeared upon the walls? Were you thinking of your cousin after torture, or Tel Aviv and its glittering shopping malls? When the fat men in their mansions say that you don't want peace, did you wonder what they mean as you sat amidst the stench inside the darkness in the shattered city of Jenin? What went through your mind at the sight of your mother's vacant eyes, as she lay still among the rubble beneath the blue Middle Eastern skies? As you stood upon this bulldozed building beside the settlements and their hills so green, gave way to grim determination amidst the ruins of the city of Jenin. as you stepped on board. The crowded bus across the green line, and you reached inside your jacket for the cord. Were you thinking of your neighbor's buried bodies as you made the stage for this scene? As you set off the explosives that were strapped around your waist, were you thinking of the city of Jenin?
Even if the people of North America don't give a toss about the victims of Sabra and Shatila, the victims of Jenin, the victims of hundreds of massacres, even if they don't care about the Palestinian refugees, even if they don't care that Palestine has been wiped off the map, please believe me, the Muslims of the world care about it very much indeed. And it's one of the main reasons why there's such hatred against the West out there in that swamp of hatred and bitterness in the Muslim world, out of which the monstrosities of 9/11 and 7/7 in London and other atrocities climbed. Now, they often say to me when I make these points, well, what would you do? How would you get us out of this mess? I always say it's a bit much asking me to get you out of the mess. If you'd listened to me, you wouldn't have been in the mess in the first place. They say, what do you want us to do? You want us to negotiate with Osama bin Laden? Do you think bin Laden is interested in negotiating with us? I say, I don't know. You know him better than me. After all, you invented Osama bin Laden. He's only in Afghanistan because you sent him there. Don't try and hang bin Laden around my neck. I was the last man standing in the British Parliament, I mean literally, on the eve of the fall of Kabul to the so-called Mujahideen, of which the Taliban and bin Laden and the gang of warlord drug barons that your army and my army is currently defending in Afghanistan, on the eve of their triumph. And I told Mrs. Thatcher, you have opened the gates for the barbarians. And a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And I never said a truer word. I say I'm not trying to negotiate with bin Laden. I want to negotiate with those Muslims who haven't joined him yet, but who may join him tomorrow because of their anger and their rage at the double standards of your governments towards the people of the East, towards the Muslim world, and in particular and specially towards the people of Palestine. So I said to them, give me the keys. I'll reverse the vehicle. But we have to go in the opposite direction. We have to make reparations to the Palestinian people. We have to start treating them as the victims and Israel as the criminals. We have to ensure that every Palestinian refugee is able to return to their home and that a Palestinian state is created with Jerusalem as its capital. And the second thing we have to do is we have to withdraw from these disastrous occupations of Muslim lands on which we are engaged, which are doing no good. Even the chief of the British Army General Staff told Mr. Blair in public, in what was effectively a mutiny, holding the flagship of his own government under the waterline, that the presence of British forces in Iraq was causing more harm than it could possibly do good, and that we must leave, and leave soon. Nowadays you cannot find any spokesman from the British government, or increasingly from the American government, who will defend the cataclysmic, earth-shattering, disfiguring crime that they committed when they invaded Iraq on a pack of lies. Every single thing the anti-war movement said, and your anti-war movement was more successful than ours. You pulled Canada out of the war. Otherwise, it would have been in the war if it was not for your anti-war movement led by the Stop the War Coalition. None of them now defend it. Now they're asking me how to solve it. How could you defend it? There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no link to 9/11. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but there is now thousands and thousands of Al-Qaeda in Iraq now. There was no Islamist fundamentalist fanaticism in Iraq, but there is now. They armed Saddam Hussein and gave him money to fight Iran for 8 years, killing 1 million people because of their fear of the Islamic Revolution and Khomeini. Iran has now been handed Iraq lock, stock and barrel by these foreign policy geniuses, Bush, Blair, Rumsfeld, Powell and the rest. Idiots, yes. They have not just broken Iraq into 100 pieces, shattered the hearts of the Iraqis, sent millions of them spinning overseas. Anyone with legs to carry them, with a skill to sell, is leaving the country, and there are millions. They have sent a pulse of hatred across the world, the reverberations of which will blight the lives of the youngest person in this room. A generation and more will have their lives affected, disfigured, overshadowed by the scale of this disastrous crime, this cataclysmic blunder. And Iraq, poor Iraq, Iraq, which 1,000 years ago, when my ancestors were still painting their faces blue and living in the forest, Iraq had the greatest library the world had ever seen. Iraq, with all its weight, all its importance to Islam, to the Arabs, to civilization, the country where the number zero was conceptualized, where algebra was invented, where the alphabet was first written down, where paper was first used as a medium of communication, where laws were first codified, where agriculture was first planted. Such an Iraq is now in the hands of the imbecile of Crawford, Texas, George W. Bush. What a fate for such a nation. These occupations are deepening the swamp of hatred every day, watering it with new blood. Hundreds and hundreds of corpses floating up the Tigris, up the Euphrates, mounting in the morgues. Women, I had some fool say on the television here in Canada that Iraq was invaded to liberate women. Iraqi women were the freest women in the whole of the Arab world. But now they can't stand outside their door for fear of being kidnapped and raped and murdered and taken hostage. Girls can't go to school or university. Such is the total collapse of Iraq, broken into 100 pieces. So we must withdraw from these occupations. I'm sometimes told by journalists, well, if we withdraw, there'll be chaos. To which I answer, you've obviously not got a television set. The only thing the Iraqis need from us is the sight of the back of our heads getting on aeroplanes and leaving their country and leaving it to them. And lastly, the third thing that we have to do is the most important of all. We have to stop propping up those corrupt kings and puppet presidents who rule the Muslim world almost without exception. The only democratically elected government in the entire Muslim world is the Palestinian government that Canada has starved because they voted for their own party. These kings and presidents rule their countries not for their own people, but so they can loot the wealth of their own countries for the benefit of others. You know, Muslims don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear these leaders talking about fighting in Iraq for democracy, when in the country next door, Saudi Arabia, is the grimmest prison state on the earth, where there's no liberty or freedom or democracy of any kind, and never has been. Where women are not allowed to drive motor cars, not allowed to set foot on the street without a male relative, where they cut people's heads off in public, in the public squares, live on television, on Friday afternoons, for the intimidation of the others. We're fighting for democracy in Iraq whilst we're selling guns to the tyrants of Saudi Arabia to crush democracy and liberty in their own country. And there's another one I can give you, although I can give you many more, but one you probably don't know about. This day, the taxpayers of Great Britain are paying for the military training of the officer corps of the army of Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. That's the same Gaddafi that we said blew up an airliner over Lockerbie, killing hundreds of people. The same Gaddafi that we said funded the IRA's bombing campaign in England throughout the 1970s and 80s. The same Colonel Gaddafi that we said was a lunatic, a madman, a tyrant, a dictator. Does anybody think that Gaddafi changed? Or did he just change sides? Everybody knows that's why he's now a blue-eyed boy of Bush and Blair. Not because he's a different Gaddafi. He's still a son of a bitch, but he's now our son of a bitch. He's now our son of a bitch. If you give me the keys, that's the direction that we need to go. They're not going to give me the keys. But we have to build a movement so big and so powerful and so united that we can force those who do have the keys to put on the brakes, to find the gear stick with the reverse gear, to stop watering the swamp with new blood, to start draining the swamp with policies of fairness and justice and equality. The slogan of the anti-war movement, which I like the best, which sums up not only our message best, but the quintessential truth in this story. No justice, no peace. If there's no justice, there will be no peace. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the Galloway speech, our thanks to Alex Smith, the Brown Bagger, and radio station CFRO in Vancouver. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of anyone except me and George Galloway. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust wishing you a good week and advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, and, to paraphrase Phil Berrigan, let's see if we can live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao!